This is John DeGruchy, and this is a presentation entitled South Africa, Cry the Beloved Country Revisited. What I'm going to attempt to do this evening is to put together in one presentation what I did in four presentations last week, and what I spent 12 weeks doing during the semester, the last semester, while teaching in the Eastern Coast. I've been a visiting professor at Princeton this last semester. So we're going to do a very condensed kind of thing. And we are aware of the fact that at 8 o'clock a lot of other people want to come here to pray and to worship and do that sort of thing. And we'll join with them, of course, in Vespers. So I'm going to move rather rapidly, but please don't feel that that means you shouldn't ask any questions. But the answers may be a little short, and you'll just have to bear with me on that. I will be talking again on the church and the struggle against apartheid later in the week. I think it's on Thursday, and then again something on Saturday. Tomorrow I'll be doing something different, talking about healing. Now, I've called this Cry the Beloved Country Revisited because a lot of people in North America are perhaps familiar with South Africa because at some point in their lives they read Ellen Payton's novel, Cry the Beloved Country. And it still is a very powerful book, and it's still very widely read, and it's going into fresh editions regularly. It's also a textbook you may be interested to know in South African schools. So I thought what would be interesting would be to use this as a point of departure. We're not going to talk about the book, but we're going to remember that this book was written in 1947. Not in 1957 or 67 or 77. 1947, that's a few years ago. It was before the National Party came to power. It was before the policy of apartheid was put into effect. Not before segregation was put into effect in one way or another, but before apartheid became a world known word. So my question is, in what way has South Africa moved since Ellen Payton wrote Cry the Beloved Country, now going on for, what is it, nearly 40 years ago. He wrote it, incidentally, while he was in a hotel room in Stockholm, if I remember rightly. He also wrote the foreword to my book, and lots of people say that's the best part to it. There's a quotation at the end of the book from Ellen Payton, which I think is perhaps the best thing that I've picked up about Christian hope. Ellen Payton's book is about a black family, about migratory labor, about a black minister, and all of those themes are very important for understanding contemporary South Africa. Black labor, the black church, the migratory labor system, the uprooting of people, separation of husband from family because of labor, and so on. And that'll come through in what I'm going to talk about this evening. Are there any questions before we proceed to look at some slides and some overhead pictures, rather charts and maps? Okay. That is Southern Africa. And a quick orientation may be helpful, just to place South Africa in its context. When we look at that map, we are looking at Southern Africa. Africa south... That's Cry, but not the Beloved Country. So, we're looking at Southern Africa. Africa south of the equator, and at a whole number of countries. Now, lots of people sometimes forget that South Africa is not Southern Africa, it is a country. It's not like South America, okay? South Africa is a country, and it's shaded in red, and it is surrounded by a number of other countries. That map was drawn before Rhodesia became Zimbabwe, indeed before Southwest Africa was more commonly called, even in South Africa, by the name Namibia. But that is South Africa set in the midst of Southern Africa. Now, you may be interested in getting some feel for the distances that we're talking about. From east to west, it's actually more than 1,000 miles. I'm not quite sure. My wife drew this for me some time ago. It's more than 1,000 miles, but at any rate, it's from here to where? Where's 1,000 miles from Holden Village? I don't know. At any rate, you get some idea when you think in those terms. And it's 1,500 miles from Cape Town in the south to the northern border of the province called Transvaal. The major cities, Pretoria, the capital city, Johannesburg, the largest city, Durban on the east coast, the second largest city and biggest harbour, Cape Town in the bottom corner here, the third largest city and second largest harbour. So that's South Africa. That's its size. It's a tenth the size of the United States, excluding Alaska, and it's four times the size of Texas, for what that's worth. Any questions about that?
When was America discovered, incidentally? I keep on forgetting. When? 1492. Okay, there was nobody here before that.
Yes.
Okay. So South Africa wasn't discovered by Europeans. It already existed before they came. And that's important to keep in mind, both in terms of North America and Southern Africa. There were in South Africa, down near Cape Town, down here, tribes called the San and the Khoi, popularly known, but in a pejorative way, as Bushmen and Hottentots, down in the south. And they were there many thousands of years before white people came to South Africa. But round about the 14th, 15th century, before 1652, when the first white settlers came to the Cape, you already had black tribes migrating from Central Africa down into South Africa. The Venda people, the Tswana, the Sotho, Tsonga, Southern Sotho, and the Nguni people, from which come the Zulu and the Xhosa tribes. And these black tribes migrated down into Southern Africa, into South Africa, as we have it there, in the two centuries, probably, maybe earlier, before the whites came to South Africa. And out of that migration, which took, as I say, many years, the various tribal groups formed in South Africa and established there. In 1652, the first Dutch colonists came to the Cape to provide a watering station for ships going from Holland to the East Indies. And they established this at Cape Town there in the southern tip. They were soon joined by some French Huguenots who, because of persecution in France, came out and settled there in 1687, and some German Protestants, some German Lutherans, who were forced to become Dutch Calvinists. But they didn't. But the French Huguenots did. There's a story in that. But out of those three groups, the Dutch, the French, and the German, predominantly Dutch, came what is now called the Afrikaner group, who speak a language that is similar to Dutch, but Dutch that's gone through a number of changes, and which we now call Afrikaans. As jy kan plat Deutsch verstaan, dan kan jy Afrikaans verstaan. Mm-hmm. Did anybody understand that? Okay, good. Now, when they came, they met the Khoi and the San, the so-called Bushmen and Hottentots, who were hunters and herders and gatherers, and or rather gatherers and hunters, not herders. And so they didn't particularly like relating to the Dutch settlers as laborers on farms and so on. They also went through a number of disastrous epidemics. Smallpox, for one, decimated the Khoi and San populations, and they generally moved out of the Western Cape area into the interior. If you've read Lawrence van der Post, you'll have read about the Bushmen of the Kalahari and so on.
When the Dutch settlers began to move into the interior, into the farmlands that they opened up in the Western Cape, they needed slaves. Where were they to get slaves? Well, at this stage, they hadn't really encountered the black peoples coming down, already settled in the interior of South Africa. But they, as Dutch, they had the opportunity of bringing slaves from the east, from Malaya, from Madagascar also. And so the slaves that came to South Africa didn't come, they weren't South African blacks, they were brought from the east, from Malaya. And that's how Islam first came to South Africa. So the slaves were Malayan, Malagasy, and Samkhoi and San, who did work for the white farmers down there. We're talking now about the early 17th, middle 17th century, or rather the 18th century. And gradually the white farming community moved out into the interior and began to establish towns like Graaffreinet, which I've put on the map there. Gosh, never let you... Oh, okay. I thought my wife would run off with this. The next major development in South African history was the taking over of the Cape by the British, which resulted from a defeat of Holland in wars in Europe. In 1806, the first British occupation of the Cape, and a little while later, the second, and then permanent control of the Cape up until, in fact, 1910. In 1820, the British authorities sent out to South Africa British settlers, and they settled them there. You can see at the bottom of the map, now there's the city of Port Elizabeth. They settled them there in order to open up the country and possibly to stabilize it. Now, it was very interesting that they should have been settled there, because by this stage, of course, the black tribes that had come down from the north were well settled there on the Kai River. The Afrikaner farming communities had moved into the interior and were there in Graaffreinet, Somerset East, and near Port Elizabeth. The 1820 settlers were put right in between, between the black tribes and the Afrikaner farmers. And they came from London and Birmingham and Bristol and Southampton, and which, as you know, aren't cities known for their farming. These were clerks and Methodist preachers and people like that. And suddenly they found themselves in a very wild, rugged terrain as a buffer community between an expanding Afrikaner farming community and an expanding black community from the north. But that's where the English really first made a contribution or an impact or an entrance into South Africa. In 1850s, another group of British settlers came to Natal. Once the British had taken occupation of the Cape, they began to influence the direction in which the Cape was to be governed, and very soon that meant the emancipation of the slaves. And that in turn led many Afrikaner farmers, the Boers — Boer means a farmer — to trek into the interior in the so-called Great Trek. And those red lines show how the Afrikaner farmers in those outlying towns, not so much nearer Cape Town, but they began to move into the interior and to open up settlements there, of course encountering as they went tribal groups that were already settled there before they came, but there was plenty of land and plenty of space for everybody. Well, that's another whole story, and if you've read The Covenant by Michener, you'll know it all off by heart. The next major development in South African history came as a result of the discovery of diamonds in Kimberley in 1870, and then of gold in what is called the Witwatersrand, the White Waters Ridge, which is now where Johannesburg is built. And that opened up the country. A whole lot of people came to work on the mines and to make money, and it eventually contributed to what is called the Anglo-Boer War, which is something like the Civil War here in the United States. A war between the two Boer republics of the Transvaal and the Free State against Britain, which controlled the Cape and Natal. those two provinces, the one on the right where Durban is and the Cape down here. And that war was fought at the turn of the century between British and Boer. It was fought over a number of issues, again, which we can't get into tonight, and was eventually won by the British. But it was a very sad war, as wars always are. I think it was the first war, modern war certainly, in which concentration camps were used by the British against the Boer women and children, and that still leaves a very sour feeling amongst Afrikaans people in South Africa. My wife was at a meeting in Princeton earlier this year at which an Afrikaans person was speaking about South Africa. And after she had done, she asked my wife if she had any comments, and she made a few critical comments and gave a different interpretation of South African history and where we are at this present time. And afterwards, this Afrikaans person said to another friend that she was very cross with what my wife had said, and it just went to show that what her mother had told her as a little girl was true, that you can never trust the British after what they did to us in the concentration camps during the Boer War. Now, that's still a part of the South African saga, story. You need to keep that in mind, that there's a very real cleavage between Afrikaner and English, although that in some ways has been bridged in more recent history because of relations between black and white, which we'll be coming to. Indian laborers came in from India. Of course, you know the story of Gandhi, and he was a lawyer that worked amongst the Indian community in Natal. Chinese came into the Witwatersrand and started laundries and Chinese restaurants. So you end up with a picture something like this. It's changed a little bit as the population has grown. A country of 26 million made up of African tribal groups, about 18 to 20 million, probably a little more than 20 million today. The so-called coloured community. Now, that word coloured is a very pejorative word in the United States, and I'm very much aware of that, so please just bear with me for a moment. But in South Africa, it refers to people of mixed race, mainly coming out of the intermarriages that took place among settlers and slaves and others in the Cape, the Western Cape. But each of these groups is, in law and in the political setup in South Africa, distinguished in terms of identity and identity documents and all the rest. So however invidious it is, there's no other way that I can talk reasonably about it. So the Cape Coloured community of about 2.5 million, the Asian community of just under 1 million, and the white community now nearing 5 million, the majority of whom are Afrikaans, and then a sizable English-speaking community. Any questions about that? Now, keep in mind that you've got a black majority. Many colored people would identify themselves with the black majority. Some would identify themselves with the white minority. So they're kind of people in between. They do not speak an indigenous African language, but English or Afrikaans, whereas the African people all speak an indigenous language, whether it be Zulu or Shangaan or Venda, Tswana, whatever it may be. But that is the racial mix. And South African politics and apartheid is all built around these different identities, different cultural, racial, ethnic identities. Okay, could we have the lights off? Well, we've already seen a map of South Africa. There is another one, so we'll move on. The earliest people were, as I've said, San and Khoi, and they are famous for their rock paintings. These paintings I discovered in a cave in the Drakensberg in Natal. They probably date from the 14th century, but of course the Khoi were painting many, many centuries before that. There's another painting. You can see the men going off to hunt. Okay, and there's a beast over there of some sort, probably a buck of some kind. Remarkable paintings. Bear in mind that that was painted about, 1400, where are we now? 1900, 500 years ago. And it's out in the open. It's got a bit of an overhanging rock to protect it. This is part of the peninsula where Cape Town is built. And whenever we have visitors visiting us in Cape Town, one of the things we do is to drive them around the peninsula. I wish we had time to show you more pictures of Cape Town, which, next to Seattle, of course, is the most beautiful country town in the world. That's another picture of a view in Cape Town. It's back to front, but none of you would know that, so we won't try and change it. I don't quite know how it got in back to front. It's a little bay called Hout Bay. That looks down to Cape Point. I'm just giving you a quick look at Cape Town. Last week I spoke about South Africa, land of paradox, and showed how beauty and pain coexist. The beauty of the country, the beauty of many of the peoples and cultures, and yet the pain of apartheid and all that that means. You know, I think all these slides are in back to front. Now, how did that happen? That's very bad. I'm sorry about that. We don't spill pearl like that. We do lots of things back to front, but that we don't do. Jan van Riebeck, the first Dutch governor at the Cape, 1652, he landed just at the spot, which at that time was sea, but has since been reclaimed, and a lot of modern Cape Town is built on reclaimed land. The Dutch farmers, once they got established, built very beautiful homes. The architecture is called Cape Dutch, the Dutch gable, the thatch roof, some beautiful carpentry, and most of these farms were wine farms. There is a picture of a wine farm not very far from Cape Town, about 30 miles away. That is upside down. Is there anything we can do about that, or is it just going to be too... I'm sorry about this. Now, here you have the descendants of slaves, Cape Colored people, working on a strawberry farm. Now, of course, not all the descendants work on farms. Many of them are teachers in education, ministers, doctors, and so on. I am told that there's something like 10,000 Cape Colored doctors practicing in Canada, and that if they stopped practicing in Canada, the medical services in Canada would collapse. Well, that's another story. But here, that's part of Table Mountain over there, and here are some laborers working on a strawberry farm. Well, let's just hope that we're not going to have too much trouble in terms of... South Africa has some very beautiful flora and fauna and countryside. This is a famous garden in Cape Town called Kirstenbosch. And one could show many slides similar to this. Another picture in Cape Town. The mountains there are called the 12 Apostles. There are 12 of them. And again, you see something of the rugged beauty of Cape Town. This is the Atlantic Ocean. The other pictures you've been seeing are the Indian Ocean. That's the university where I teach. My office is there, just there. Okay? We live around the corner somewhere there. And that university was founded about 160 years ago, the first university to be established in South Africa. It has 10,000 students. 10% of the students are black students. I suppose its most famous professor is Chris Barnard, who did his thing with somebody's heart some time ago. Here is a picture of graduation, a very familiar picture to anybody in North America, graduation day. This is after the crowds had begun to disperse. But just to give you some idea of the fact that we don't all live in mud huts. Now, the Dutch settlers came to South Africa in 1652, and they were, of course, to a man, virtually all members of the established Dutch Reformed Church, the Netherlands Reformed Church, the state church in Holland. And that became the official religion at the Cape, and it was the official religion of the Cape for about 150 years. The Lutherans, the German Lutherans, were not allowed to build a church building until 1790, almost 150 years after they came. The Dutch Calvinist religion was the official religion. And already in the middle of the 19th century, they had established a seminary at Stellenbosch, 30 miles from Cape Town. Those of you who are familiar with church history might be familiar with the name Andrew Murray, who was one of the great pietist leaders within the Dutch Reformed Church in the 19th century, and he had a hand in establishing this. And this produces many, many Dutch Reformed ministers every year, perhaps 300 or 400. There are four such theological seminaries of the Dutch Reformed Church in South Africa. It's a very strong church. But Christianity is not the only religion in South Africa. I've already mentioned the Malays who came from the east. They were generally Muslim, and here's a fairly large mosque outside of Cape Town, and that's one of many such mosques that you will find in the Cape Town area and in other parts of South Africa, particularly in Durban. Now we're moving away from Cape Town, and we've gone up the east coast. If you remember the map, here was Cape Town, there was Port Elizabeth. Well, we're up here near the Kai River. Now, this was the kind of territory that those British settlers from Bristol and London and Southampton and Birmingham found themselves dumped in. Pretty barren, but a rugged beauty, populated by the Xhosa people. And the characteristic flower called the aloe. Perhaps you've seen that play by Athol Fugard, about the aloe. You can see how different the ecology is here to that of Cape Town. And of course, South Africa is a very large country by most standards. And the geography varies, the climate varies, the people vary. My accent is different to my wife. She comes from Johannesburg, I come from Cape Town. We have a different English accent, although you may not realize it, we do. There are many, many differences all over the country. This is in the Transkei. And that rock is the legendary rock from which people deserving capital punishment were thrown off by the Xhosa chiefs earlier in their history. You didn't survive the fall if you were thrown off there. You didn't quite make it to the bottom. At least you made it, but there wasn't much left of you. Now, I mentioned that climate and ecology vary. This is that same part of the country that we've just been looking at, that very dry area called Transkei. And we were driving through it one winter's day, and suddenly we found ourselves in the midst of a snowstorm. It was a surprise for everybody, especially for the people living there. Also for us who were driving through it. You know, if we have a snowstorm in South Africa, it's very rare, perhaps every 25 years, except in the high mountainous areas. And you don't quite know how to drive on snow, and you certainly don't have snow tires and that sort of thing. But there you see Transkei as it normally is in the winter, with the snow on the mountains and the cornfields.
A little village that Alan Paton's novel, it's one of the chief characters, went to the mines in Johannesburg. And I guess that if the story were told about each one of those little huts, somebody from them at some point in time would have left and gone off to Johannesburg, 500-600 miles away, to work on the mines. Well, our son now is 22, but I shouldn't think that this countryside has changed a great deal in those 22 years, or I forget how old he was then. But this is virtually the place where Alan Paton's novel is situated, near Ikopo in Natal. And it could be that it was a boy like this, the same age as our son, probably a little older,
in that picture that we've just seen, was in Alan Paton's mind when he started to write the story. He had two little boys, probably herders, down in the southern part of Natal, not too far from Ikopa. And here we have a shot of a part of Johannesburg, and it's to the mines. There you see a mine dump, something like the mine tailings, are there? Here, over there in the city, gold mine tailings. It's to Johannesburg that the laborers come to work on the mines. Now, I mentioned the Afrikaner and the Great Trek and the struggle against the British and all that. In 1948, the Afrikaner National Party came to power. And they came to power with the political program called apartheid. Apartheid means separateness. And the policy was to govern the country on the basis of separating people and allowing them to develop separately. In practical terms, it meant separating blacks from participating in the political and economic life of South Africa. It meant a whole bunch of legislation that discriminated against blacks in favor of whites and enabling white power to be maintained. Now, behind that philosophy was an awareness that the Afrikaner and whites in South Africa are a minority group, and that if everybody had power and if the vote was given to everybody, then the Afrikaner and the whites reasoned their future in South Africa would not be a particularly hopeful or bright one. And that mentality went back to the Great Trek. The Afrikaner felt continually that they were being forced by the British in the first instance, but also by the blacks, to lose their identity as Afrikaners, continually to move into the interior, and to protect themselves from alien influences. In 1938, they laid the foundation of the Voortrekker Monument, which is just outside Pretoria. And it is a monument which was opened 10 years later to the Voortrekkers, those who went on the Great Trek, and to the Afrikaner folk, the Afrikaner people. It is a monument of their identity, and it's designed as a lager. If you were to go and visit it, you'd see that around the monument set above Pretoria are ox wagons, just as the Voortrekkers drew up a lager every night to protect themselves from the black tribes in the interior. So the monument is designed in the same way. When Eberhard Betke and his wife Renata visited South Africa in 1973, I took them to see this monument, and they said, that's just like the kind of thing that was happening in Germany in the 1930s and earlier in German history, building these vast granite monuments to German or Germanic identity. And it's only when you visited that monument that you really understand what the Afrikaner people are all about. And inside the monument on the 16th of December, the Day of the Covenant, again another story, the sun at noonday will shine right down through the center of the building, right down into that open tomb there to the basement. And I think at the bottom there's an open Bible. I'm not sure about that anymore. You have to understand apartheid as a struggle for whites to maintain power and supremacy, for Afrikaners to retain their identity as well. And the way to do that, so it is argued, is to divide and rule. This is a typical black township. This one, I took this photograph about 20 years ago, so it must have changed a great deal. It's outside Durban in a little township called Umlazi. But Soweto is not very different from that, although Soweto has grown into a vast city complex. Something's happened there. Never mind, that's a snowstorm in Johannesburg. We'll move on. Whoops. That's back to front, but at any rate, it's an important picture. When blacks come to the cities, whether as mine laborers or
in whatever capacity they come, or whether if they're born there, they will get an identity document called a passbook. Now, each South African carries an identity document in which your race and classification number is stated. The passbook has, however, was instituted before everybody else carried them, and for blacks, and in the first instance, black males. And it was a way of controlling black labor, preventing the influx of blacks into the cities, except those who had a right to be there because they were employed as laborers on the mines or in other capacities. Now, it was the pass laws, when they were extended to include black women, that led to the Sharpeville massacre in 1957, when a very large group of black protesters, non-violent protesters, descended on the police station in Sharpeville, and the police, who were quite clearly, of course, outnumbered, but nevertheless had guns and everything else and needn't have done this, ended up by firing on these demonstrators, and over 100 people were killed. You can see that this is taken just after the Sharpeville massacre, and some fleeing away, some dead here. And it was that event in 1957 which sparked off the worldwide opposition to apartheid and launched the anti-apartheid movements in many parts of the world. I was a theological student at that time, and I remember the shockwaves that went through our university and throughout South Africa. One of the great leaders of the African National Congress, and one who is very much involved in the protests against the pass laws and against apartheid, was Albert Luthuli, who was a deacon of our church in Natal. And he was very much involved in the events leading up to Sharpeville and after. Possibly of all South African black leaders, he was the most committed to Gandhi's non-violent approach towards change, although by no means the only one. If you want to read a very important book on the black struggle in South Africa, read his biography, Let My People Go. Robert Sobukwe, another nationalist leader who died recently after spending many years, perhaps 15 years, in prison on Robben Island. It's interesting, you see, Luthuli was a Congregational Church deacon, Sobukwe was a Methodist lay preacher. Black leadership in South Africa in the nationalist movement for liberation generally come out of the church. And you've got to bear in mind that the church in South Africa is 80% of the population, and also that about 75% of the church is black. Nelson Mandela is the only major nationalist leader still in South Africa and still alive. Luthuli, as I say, died 15 years ago. Sobukwe more recently. Nelson Mandela is the leader of the African National Congress. He is in prison on Robben Island and has been for, I think, 19 years. A typical area, I think this is a colored living area near Cape Town. You have a very wide range, of course. You have some very wealthy colored people as well as very poor. These are obviously poorer areas, and that would be where the majority of people would be. This is a black area outside Cape Town, giving you some idea of segregated housing and living conditions. The difference I find between, let's say, these townships and Harlem and black ghettos in America is that you don't have those high-rise apartments and all that goes with them. There's more space, more breathing space, and more room for kids to play and that sort of thing, but not altogether dissimilar. Some of it's pretty barren. The government is making an effort now to develop new housing areas like this one at Mitchell's Plain, black housing areas, and trying to meet some of the backlog in terms of housing in urban areas for the black community. And you'll find many of these kind of townships being developed both through government agencies and private enterprise. And that requires, of course, the development of churches. I spend a lot of time working with a group that is developing church communities in these new black townships in Cape Town. This is a church building that we opened just before I came away at the end of last year. And it's a tremendous financial and time drain on the people involved. But Mitchell's Plain, which started about 8 years ago, already has 300,000 people living there, and will have probably 500,000 within the next 5 or 6 years. And the church fulfills a tremendous role, as you know, in the community. Like providing creches for kids during the day when the parents go off to work. This is a squatter township called Crossroads near Cape Town. And that's another story. Wish I had time to tell you more about it. Interesting little church here. Apostolic Faith Assembly Church of Africa. And if you had to go inside there, you'd find a little altar with candles on it and benches, and probably on a Sunday, a very charismatic type service. The church in these kind of communities, of course, is the one place where people discover some sign of hope, some way of handling the day-to-day harsh realities under which they live. Oh, that's upside down. But if you can turn your head at a right angle, are we going to do something about that? We're getting there. Whoops. Okay. Inside these little shanty houses that we've just been looking at, you will find some amazing things. You'll find dignity, self-respect. You'll find hi-fi radios. You'll find televisions, television sets. You will find, well, like houses should be, homes. And one of the great tragedies often of these places is that if the people are squatting there illegally, well, it could happen that the authorities will come and bulldoze your house down. The churches in Cape Town, or some of them, got together and built a clinic for the people at Crossroads, and here you see the clinic. Interesting story behind that. The doctor in charge there was a student at our university. He's a young doctor who refused to do military service, although he finally agreed to be a doctor on the border, where the border war is at the present time. But as soon as he got out of that, instead of going into private practice, he decided that he would give at least this time in his life to working for very little pay at Crossroads, and together with some support from the church, has built this clinic. But there, you see, there were little houses and little shacks all over here before they were bulldozed down by the authorities one midwinter's night. Here's some more built over there. Again, I wish there was time to talk about that. Now, one of the very... one of the saddest parts of the apartheid philosophy requires that people, black people on the whole, virtually always, often have to move from places where they've been living for long periods of time and go and live in other parts of the country. And this picture here is a graphic description of people leaving their homes and picking up their belongings, moving off to a collecting point to get onto a truck to go to a new town, because this area now is going to become part of perhaps another homeland, and they're the wrong tribe, or it could be that it's part of a white area. Who knows what that particular picture, what the story is that lies behind that. Now, that kind of transit camp, which is so familiar to people who are familiar with refugee stories all over the world, is true also in South Africa.
The church is often very deeply involved in trying to meet needs of people living in transit camps as they move from one part to another, or if they're refugees in countries around South Africa. Of course, this kind of picture leads the government to try and improve on the way in which people do get moved around and dumped in places, and sometimes it's better than what that picture portrays, but often it's like that. How do people respond to apartheid? Well, some black leaders, like Gatsha Buthelezi, the chief of the Zulus, tries to work within the system in order to change it. Many young blacks, like these in Cape Town, take to the streets, as they did in 76 and 77, in protest and in confrontation with the white authorities. And that leads to the kind of outbreak of protest and violence and counter-violence in Soweto that hit the headlines in 76. Anti-protest meetings, this is such a familiar sight, if you're involved at all in the church's struggle in South Africa. Notice the protest meeting is taking place inside a church. It's a Catholic church, the Catholic Pro-Cathedral in Soweto, a very vast church, indicates how closely the church, at least part of the church, is involved in the struggle for human rights and dignity. The future of South Africa, of course, could be white and black devouring each other, and in the end, nobody coming out on top. South Africa is a very powerful military and police state, and there's no guarantee that the black struggle will necessarily end in black liberation. But unless some solutions are found that involve everybody in the process, that's the kind of tragedy that could finally overwhelm and engulf us. The alternative is to learn how to break bread together and to share. And that, of course, is what the churches who are concerned to overcome apartheid in their own lives and in society at large are attempting to work at, because time runs out, and before you know where you are, there may not be an opportunity for working for reconciliation in such a way that a Holocaust could be avoided. So when the South African Council of Churches meets in its national conference, as this picture portrays, black and white Christians together try to work at the issues in a way that will bring about greater justice and equity and therefore provide the basis for reconciliation and peace. Desmond Tutu, the General Secretary of the South African Council of Churches, an Anglican bishop, a very fine leader in South Africa. His book, Crying in the Wilderness, is in the bookstore. Again, a tremendous story to be told about him as one who I think has a word of prophetic hope and insight for South Africa. Marnus Buthelezi, a Lutheran bishop who is now president of the South African Council of Churches, and again an insightful leader, one who is seeking in through Christian faith and confessing Christ as Lord to meet the kind of challenge that the church confronts. Black and white worshipping together, that commercial up on the top there is going to do with what the picture's about. It's just a public hall that was used for a big conference of Methodists where black and white came together for 10 days, black and white Methodists, to work through the problems of South Africa. And that kind of event is very common in South Africa today. There's much more black and white mixing in South Africa in the churches and in conferences and synods in South Africa than in North America, and a great deal of coming together to try and resolve the problems. Black and white worshipping together. And on rare occasions, black church leaders like Bishop Tutu and Sam Booty meeting with the Prime Minister Buddha and other cabinet ministers to talk fairly straightly to each other about the situation in South Africa. Not a great deal comes from this, but every now and again it's tried, and one hopes that some sort of progress is made. Black leadership in the church is very important. One of the Catholic bishops, shortly after his consecration, more and more the black voice is being heard in the church as black leadership takes a very prominent place. Some black theologians at the opening of one of our seminaries, which is now an integrated multiracial seminary, and a white student of ours who spent a year and a half in prison as a conscientious objector, just to indicate that black and white together are in the struggle, young blacks and young whites sharing together in trying to make a common future that will be more just and more peaceful. And finally, we come back again to the focal point of our Christian faith, sharing in the body of Christ, breaking bread together, attempting to work as Christians for a new society.